The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Derek Dorch of the Diversa Group, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dorch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Thank you for coming by the show. We're always glad to have you. Today we're going to be talking about an interesting topic. It hasn't necessarily hit the major news networks as much as it should have, but Boko Haram, the group in Nigeria, the terrorist group in Nigeria, they just pledged allegiance to ISIS. As we know, ISIS has been something that we have all been monitoring going on in areas of Syria, Iraq, and other areas all around the Middle East. But Boko Haram now in Africa, Nigeria, has also now pledged their allegiance to ISIS. We want to find out what that means. We want to find out what's going on in terms of Africa, what's going on with the upcoming elections in Nigeria, and what it means for U.S. national security and also just the international security as a whole. We're talking to an expert on this. We're talking to Mark Schroeder. He is the Vice President of Africa Analysis at Stratfor. Stratfor is a private sector and private intelligence firm, I should say. They deal with all the geo intelligence issues, political risk issues, covering the whole world. And you can find them at stratfor.com. They are definitely one of our favorite guests, and Mark has been on here before. So welcome back, Mark.
Thanks a lot, Derek. Great to be back on your program.
Always great to have you, Mark. Hey, talk to us about this whole Boko Haram. Was this a strategic dynamic? Was this more for press? I mean, what was this whole thing with Boko Haram now pledging their allegiance to ISIS?
Yeah, we would assess it's more about the propaganda value of it as opposed to kind of a concrete move that, you know, that some might say would consolidate a degree of cooperation between the two militant groups. There's really, you know, kind of a not a very close relationship between ISIS and Boko Haram, and Boko Haram has definitely seen some setbacks on the battlefield over the last few weeks, and we would assess this this declaration of allegiance to ISIS would be kind of a move to, you know, hopefully recruit some support or gain some notoriety or otherwise, you know, try to stem the losses that they've found over the last few weeks.
You know, I know that the African Union has really been, you know, a lot of the regional partners, not only the Nigerian military, but now you've got the regional countries around Nigeria now dedicating some troops to kind of deal with this Boko Haram situation. What are we seeing? I mean, you just kind of mentioned that the tide is turning. I mean, is this a serious tide turning, a temporary setback? What are you seeing?
Yeah, and that's absolutely a great question. And you know, just to take a step back for a moment, you know, until the last few weeks, you know, the Nigerian government and its military have really been hesitant or reluctant or just, you know, just not very effective at engaging Boko Haram on the battlefield. And Boko Haram has even conducted operations across Nigerian borders into neighboring countries, including into Chad and Cameroon and Niger. Now, what you have seen is those countries have responded over the last couple of months and mobilized their own military forces and even tried to coordinate kind of a multinational military force among those Francophone African neighbors to Nigeria. So again, these forces from Niger, from Chad and Cameroon, consolidating kind of their border security operations and even conducting some limited cross-border interventions into Nigeria. And that, you know, was initially driven by kind of the weak response by the Nigerians. Of course, that has kind of triggered political, you know, controversy in Nigeria. Nigeria, of course, has a long history of, you know, kind of being the strongest and most powerful state in the entire West African region. And when it sees its smaller neighbors, you know, being more successful militarily against this Nigerian terrorist group, you know, that raises a lot of questions over what is exactly the Nigerian government doing or what are they failing to do and why is that going on? So finally, over the last few weeks, we're seeing kind of a greater effectiveness by the Nigerian government empowering the Nigerian military and, you know, and a limited degree of coordination with these other neighboring African countries to really try to put some greater counterinsurgency operations against the Boko Haram group.
You know, you bring to a whole bunch of interesting questions because we've got these elections coming up. Good Luck Jonathan is running against his opponents and everything else. And so everybody's trying to get who's going to be. Are the Christians still going to maintain control of the country? Are those in the kind of north and south kind of battle just depend on who's going to be running the country? Is this, increase of Nigerian military, is it more about the politics? Because the elections are only maybe a couple weeks away. Is it more about the politics? I mean, why hadn't the military taken these issues have been going on for years. We've been dealing with Boko Haram for all this time. So why now?
That's absolutely the critical question to ask. And, until the last few weeks, there really has been kind of backpedaling by the Nigerian military against Boko Haram. And I would say, when it comes down to this election, the President Good Luck Jonathan administration, they have gone from a position of, clearly winning re-election to clearly risking the loss of re-election. And it's an extremely close race right now. And there are several factors that are contributing to that. But, the poor handling of the counterinsurgency until now has certainly contributed to the decline of popularity of the Jonathan administration in Nigeria. And so the Good Luck Jonathan administration finally came around to telling the military and supporting the military with sufficient gear and money, to go after Boko Haram. And the military advised the government or recommended to the government, can we actually delay the elections by several weeks while we improve security in the northern part of Nigeria where Boko Haram operates? The government agreed, and that they're hoping that, through some gains on the battlefield in Nigeria, that can translate to more votes for Good Luck Jonathan in this, very close neck-and-neck re-election race. And what that means for kind of after the elections, whether, Jonathan will win re-election and will he'll sustain this more robust counterinsurgency, that remains an open question. And, in terms of, a more kind of fundamental counterinsurgency that, that includes more than just military operations, but, social and economic and political programming to kind of buy goodwill in northern Nigeria, it's not clear if that will be on the table as well. But I think to your point on, other deeper political competition issues in Nigeria and rivalries between the north and the south and constituents, including the kind of the Muslim constituency and the Christian constituency in Nigeria, these are very deeply held issues that essentially will mean the election is going to be deeply divided.
When we look at this, everybody will ask the question, why has Boko Haram been able to survive for so long? And especially when you hear about the kidnappings of these girls and, all these other kind of dynamics within this country. Is it just that they have blended back into the population? Is it just that they're in an area that, is very, very difficult to get through? I know the U.S. had dedicated U.S. Special Forces. Other countries have dedicated, resources in their Special Forces, especially after the kidnapping of the girls. People will ask, well, why has it been so difficult to locate these guys and then bring them to justice?
That's a great question. Let's remember that when the high school girls from that Chibok Secondary School were kidnapped last April, 11 months ago, at the very same time President Jonathan announced his candidacy for re-election. That was clearly his priority. That is re-election. Mm-hmm. It was not about, chasing down Boko Haram and recovering, the location and the lives of those high school girls. I think, there's a number of issues that are going on in addition to the primacy of winning re-election and devoting the government's attention towards re-election campaigning. I think also if we just look at, this region of Nigeria where Boko Haram is active, specifically the northeastern region, it's the least significantly, populated and economically robust part of the country. There's few resources there, certainly few natural resources there. There's no oil and gas, there's no mining, there's no manufacturing. that this is a region that essentially depends on welfare from the federal government. And, you know, and if you're the president of Nigeria and you have other parts of the country that, you know, are much more important commercially and economically, you know, you have to, you know, pay attention to those regions as well. And you can't afford to, you know, divert your attention to a part of the country that, you know, that is underpopulated and you know, and under-empowered economically.
Right.
And I think those are equal factors that contributed to kind of the weak hand contributing to the counterinsurgency. And then, you know, one other significant part of it, if we just kind of look at the role of the Nigerian military in the Nigerian political space, and historically, you know, this has been a very you know, contested relationship, whereas, of course, the military has, over Nigeria's history, seen itself as kind of the true defender of the state, to the point of, you know, it would overturn civilian governments or overturn, you know, rival military governments if those governments were underperforming in terms of, you know, defending the centrality of Nigerian sovereignty. So I think, you know, Goodluck Jonathan, you know, is also reluctant to empower the military as an institution for fear of having the military become too powerful and too influential in society, and, you know, fearing that military may come back and bite them and indeed, you know, subvert the government over its poor handling.
Wow. Wow. So many different issues to talk about. We're talking about Boko Haram. We're talking about what's going on. Boko Haram, the terrorist organization in Nigeria, who's pledged their allegiance to ISIS. We're talking about the impact of this. But we're also talking about the deeper implications for Africa in terms of Nigeria with the elections coming up. And what Nigeria is probably one of the strongest countries in Africa outside of South Africa and other places with a number of different resources and a lot of influence in the region in terms of working with a number of states, not only the United States, but China and other places. We're talking about this right now. We're talking to Mark Schroeder. He's the Vice President of Africa Analysis at Stratfor. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we are getting our kind of our international security, our national security update. And today we're talking about Boko Haram, the terrorist group in Nigeria, has pledged their allegiance to ISIS. And anybody who's been following the news, we know that ISIS has been one of our national security priorities right now. We've got a number of different situations going on with ISIS in Iraq, in Syria, in other areas where they've impacted Jordan and all the other regional players. And we are definitely dedicating resources to that. But now we're also dealing with the situation in Africa, in Nigeria. What's the impact of this? What's the impact of Boko Haram now saying they're tied in with ISIS? And what's the impact on elections for the future? We're talking to Mark Schroeder. He's the Vice President of African Analysis at Stratfor. You can find them at stratfor.com. They're a private sector intelligence firm that provides analysis on all the different issues around the world, have some great product and resources that you definitely have to check out, and we're talking about them today. Mark, you know, when we look at this dynamic of kind of the whole ISIS impact and we look at kind of Africa, you know, there's always that concern amongst U.S. national security and also all the Western countries and just around the world that this, you know, that this ISIS explosion or just this terrorist explosion is going to continue and go through Africa, and they're going to create more cells and everything else. Do you think, you know, we're dealing with Al-Shabaab in Somalia, we're dealing with all these kind of factions. Do you think that there's going to be a growth spurt on this, or can we contain this?
Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
But let me say, you know, some you know, fundamentals that contribute to the rise of militancy, you know, remain there. And if we look at, you know, kind of the poor state of the economies across, you know, a number of these countries in Africa that, you know, permit or facilitate, you know, unemployed youth essentially to become indoctrinated or, you know, bought off by, you know, pennies on the dollar to, you know, accept, you know, jihad and become jihadist fighters. You know, the reversal of poor economies is still kind of a long ways off in a number of these countries, you know, in Somalia, in northern parts of Nigeria, in northern parts of Mali. You know, those are difficult trends to reverse. And, you know, and then if we look at the case of, you know, the abundance of small arms and light weapons, you know, being trafficked across the desert regions of Africa, contributing to the kind of the sustainability of militant groups. You know, these are also, you know, vast stretches of remote territory that, you know, that any government is hard placed to secure. So even if there is, you know, extensive support from, you know, Western countries, including the United States and France and Britain, you know, to work with the Nigerians and the Malians and the Chadians and the Somalis, you know, these are still, you know, massive territories that are very difficult to secure against the trafficking of, you know, individual cells and light weapons that are used to, you know, sustain these various insurgencies across the region. So, you know, I would make the case that, you know, militants across North and West and East Africa, you know, will still be with us. But at the same time, you know, there are checks against these groups uniting and consolidating as a greater whole and being a threat against, you know, kind of greater regional and international security interests. And despite these, you know, calls of allegiances by al-Shabaab towards ISIS in Somalia and by Boko Haram in Nigeria towards ISIS, you know, we're not seeing kind of an entrenched relationship between these groups. You know, there are still checks against what that means for, you know, integration by these, you know, local grassroots organizations in Nigeria and Somalia and, you know, between kind of the mother body, so to speak, in Syria and Iraq.
Do we think that there is chatter going between the groups where they're, you know, ISIS, and they've been getting a couple blows lately because the Iraq army has now been pushing a little bit forward, but ISIS has said they taken over a lot of oil wells, and they've been basically trading oil and making all this money. Do you think that there's a push to get resources, for Boko Haram? Is this is why they're pledging allegiance? Is that, do we kind of maybe can see that there's chatter possibly going on between the two to say, listen, can you guys help us out in terms of more money or whatever the case is, and we'll do ABC for you?
We can expect that there's chatter and that there's, you know, relationships on a personal level, you know, individuals, you know, trafficking back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of trying to funnel greater resources, you know, between, say, northern Nigeria and the battle space in Syria and Iraq, you know, that's difficult to achieve. We haven't seen that deeper level of cooperation between those groups, you know, between Boko Haram and ISIS, or Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, for instance.
Right. You know, as we look at the elections and last few minutes that we've got, what's the implications? You know, if Goodluck Jonathan wins, or if some of his opponents win, you know, if the Muslims take over the country, what's the implications of this, Mark, in terms of, you know, where Nigeria will go forward?
Exactly. So, you know, if we think in terms of, you know, what does it mean for the counterinsurgency against Boko Haram, the Goodluck Jonathan administration, you know, that is largely Southern and Christian in its constituency, you know, really will struggle to assemble a traditional or comprehensive counterinsurgency. Yes, it has the military tool in its toolbox, but in terms of reaching out and winning the hearts and minds of the society, you know, of the economic players in northern Nigeria, they are weaker on that. And versus its opponent, General Buhari, who would have those greater relationships to form that more comprehensive counterinsurgency approach, we would expect that if the opposition in Nigeria wins the coming presidential election, there would be a more broad-based and effective counterinsurgency against Boko Haram. But you open the door to an interesting question, and that is, you know, what other reactions would we expect in Nigeria? Let's remember that Goodluck Jonathan, you know, while he might be constrained in his counterinsurgency towards Boko Haram, on the other hand, He is greatly supported by militants in the other corner of the country in the Niger Delta region, where all the oil and gas is found in Nigeria. And he's certainly supported by the militants there, who would fear that if Jonathan loses the election, you know, their patronage of, you know, speaking of the militants in the Niger Delta, you know, may be thrown under the bus. And that would raise the door of renewed instability and renewed militancy in that oil-producing Niger Delta region.
The reason, you know, that America and other countries have taken such an interest is because of that oil. It seems as if, you know, the play is the control of the parts of the country that have the oil. Is that right?
That is a big part of it. You know, oil obviously, you know, generates untold wealth in Nigeria, and it's really, you know, the only economic resource that matters in the country. And for, you know, the northern politicians that understand, you know, their local economy in the north of Nigeria is entirely dependent on, you know, welfare transfers from the central government that are accrued from oil and gas generation, you know, it's imperative for them to control that government, control that oil and gas. And you know, the opportunities for individual wealth and wealth for one's constituency, you know, are just massive. So it really, you know, drives the interests of all politicians in Nigeria, but certainly for the northern parts of the country that could not survive without the subsidies generated from that resource.
You know, as we look at Nigeria, is this going to be one of those areas that's for the U.S.? Is this one of these areas, no matter who wins, we're going to always be working with? Is this going to be a place that we're going to continue to kind of build relationship with? I mean, what do you see?
Yeah, that is actually very, very accurate to say. You know, Nigeria is, you know, one of the most, you know, strongest and powerful countries in Africa. You know, no matter the state of the insurgency or the state of the economy, it's the most populated country, it's the largest economy, and it, you know, historically has one of the strongest militaries. And if and Nigeria can perform a tremendous you know, position of a regional hegemon, you know, trying to stabilize and promote, you know, greater influence in the West Africa region, you know, if its politics are coherent. But on the other hand, seeing an unstable Nigeria or seeing a Nigeria in conflict with itself is too grave a concern and threat for stability for, you know, West and Central Africa, that, you know, that would be, you know, in the interest of the United States to moderate, basically, to bring in influence from other stakeholders to make sure, you know, Nigeria did not destabilize, you know, its own country and the region along with it.
We've been talking to Mark Schroeder. He's been giving us a really, really interesting analysis on what's going on in Africa, especially with Nigeria, especially as we look at Boko Haram and looking toward these elections. Nigeria is the key player in Africa in terms of stabilizing that region. And for U.S. and other, you know, Western countries and international bodies to begin looking at in terms of probably the next area of international development that people are looking at in terms of investing. So this is definitely something that we have to keep on monitoring and keep on putting the resources to try to make sure that this place gets right, because this is where a lot of resources and hopefully American companies and other companies will start moving into that area to provide jobs and infrastructure and other areas within the country and Africa as a whole. Mark, thank you so much for this analysis. And I want to, you know, get you back on a couple months, especially after the elections, so we can see where this is going. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Thanks so much, Derek. It's always great being on your program.
Always. When we get back, we're going to have Tristan Reed. She's a Mexico security analyst for Stratfor. She's going to give us our Mexico update and find out what's going on in Mexico with these cartels and what's going on in terms of the drug situation and the border situation and everything else. We'll be right back after this break. Listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch from Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been getting our international security update with our experts from Stratfor. We usually do this on a regular basis. We always want to keep track of what's going on around the world. A lot of times there's a whole bunch of stuff in headlines, but there's a lot of things that are not in the headlines that we need to keep track of. We just talked about Boko Haram and what was going on with them and them pledging their allegiance to ISIS. But now we want to get our Mexico update. We have on the line with us Tristan Reed. He's a Mexico security analyst at Stratfor. Stratfor is a private intelligence firm. You can find them at stratfor.com, but they provide analysis on all international security issues, and Mexico is one of their main issues that they focus in on a regular basis. They're down in Texas, so they know about the border issues, and they deal with these issues on a regular basis. Tristan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, give us an overview of what's going on with Mexico and what's the current situation right now.
Mexico, over the last year, the government has been very successful in pursuing the high-value targets of organized crime in Mexico. We've seen crime bosses from Sinaloa cartel, Los Zetas, the Gulf cartel, and Knights Templar being arrested or killed if they resist with military. However, what we're not seeing is dramatic improvements to security in the areas where these crime bosses operate. A large part of that has to do with the fact that public security is still quite weak in many areas. Tamaulipas State is a good example, which borders Texas, where we've had or even seeing high levels of intergang violence in a small portion of the border region. Likewise, down in Mexico Southwest, we're seeing serious issues with rural law, particularly in Michoacán and Guerrero State, where unrest in Guerrero State has even threatened the possibility of elections taking place there.
You know, when we look at this situation, what's the increase? I mean, is it the new political leadership saying, hey, we're going to take a no-nonsense with the cartels? Is there a changeover? I mean, at one point in time, we had a lot of corruption within the government, and the cartels were basically running, helping run the government, or they had the different people in place. Is there a changeover now? What's happening?
Well, you know, corruption is obviously a major issue in Mexico. One of the most recent high-profile incidents was back in September, where on the orders of a mayor in Guerrero State, his municipal police abducted 43 students. Presumably, they were killed. However, in terms of the violence that's going on at the border, a lot of that has to do with changes, organizational changes within organized crime itself, rather than any sudden policy change from Mexico. The Gulf cartel, which hasn't been a cohesive criminal organization in a few years now, has evolved into just a collection of very powerful street gangs. They all call themselves the Gulf cartel. And, you know, a lot of people refer to it as factional fighting, but these are independent crime groups fighting for territory. It's really been the Gulf cartel successor groups that have been causing the most violence in Tamaulipas over the last year.
Wow. You know, when we look at this dynamic, you know, where although a lot of these crime bosses have now been, you know, either arrested or killed when they're taking on the government right now, has, just as you were mentioning, there hasn't necessarily been a complete decrease in terms of the trafficking, in terms of the drugs and everything else. Are these victories major blows in which, you know, hopefully they're going to, you know, maybe cut back or disrupt these operations? Or are these victories, and then as soon as they get one person, somebody else just takes over the head of it and they just keep the ball rolling? What's happening?
Well, organized crime is particularly the drug trade through Mexico. It has this natural tendency to decentralize more and more. This is a process we've been seeing since the 1980s, when there was relatively few crime bosses controlling most of the drug trade through Mexico. One of the problems, though, is with consistent and aggressive law enforcement pressure, the illicit supply chains can't effectively be carried out with centralized control. So we're seeing more and more crime bosses with smaller niches of the overall supply of illicit drugs through Mexico into the United States. This is something that has really accelerated since 2010, where we've seen many, many fragments emerge, both within, you know, the Sinaloa cartel and with organized crime in Tamaulipas State.
You know, with this right here, with the decentralization, you know, we've seen, and I've read some articles, and tell me, you know, in terms of people crossing the border, is some of these cartels are starting to get into kind of the, you know, as we legalize marijuana, as we do certain things, are they starting to kind of diversify their business models? I mean, what's happening, especially as they decentralize, and you've got a lot more pressure on a couple of these different areas, and they're having a hard time, you know, what's the new business model for them?
Oh, yeah. Diversification is key for organized crime in Mexico, especially as we're talking about these groups getting smaller and smaller mm-hmm. because they don't have the resources to defend their territory from other criminals as they would if, you know, they controlled a much larger chunk of the drug trade. So this has pushed a lot of groups to diversify. And this is something that's not new. This has been occurring over the last several years, diversifying their activities into kidnapping, extortion. Fuel theft is perhaps the most significant issue for Mexico City at the moment because it's been blowing up over the last few years.
You know, what are we seeing in terms of kind of the border? Are we still seeing this kind of dramatic dynamics of kind of the border crossings, whether it be human trafficking or the drugs? Or are we seeing, you know, a new dynamic of methodology in which people are coming in over the sea and bringing, you know, I mean, at one time we had the cartels, you know, creating submarines and all this other kind of stuff, you know, in terms of these things, especially as they may not have the same strength as they had before. What are we seeing in terms of kind of getting things across the border and the border issues?
You know, actually, the decentralization presents greater challenges because it means that you're going to have many more groups trying very diverse ways of getting dope and getting migrants across the border.
Okay.
They are always going to be very creative in how they traffic across the border. You know, of course, in the western part of our southern border, tunnels. Narco tunnels are fairly commonplace, and these have become increasingly sophisticated, where there are advanced ventilation systems and rail systems to push carts of illicit drugs into the United States.
You know, I was reading some article. I know you contributed about this, and which is kind of startling. These cartels are now starting to create their own kind of secret communication channels. And they're also starting to kidnap very technical people, engineers, communication specialists, hackers, and things like that. What's going on with that?
You know, communication is key for the cartels in Mexico. It's a business of who you know. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you're also dealing with constant law enforcement pressure, as well as, you know, rival attacks, it's really important for these gangs to coordinate the movements of their members. And, you know, communication is also something that is highly diversified for organized crime. You know, they can use cell phones, they can use social media, they can use their own radio networks. But in order to do this, they need the expertise to build up these communication systems. There's been a lot of questions regarding whether, you know, they're kidnapping engineers and, computer specialists in order to build this up. You know, one thing to keep in mind, though, is that it's not necessary to kidnap these individuals to find the expertise they need. There's obviously kidnapping is rampant in Mexico, but it's also important to remember that there's no demographic that's selected now by organized crime. They will virtually everyone can be targeted in Mexico. So bear that in mind when you're looking at engineers being kidnapped. It's quite possible that it's the result of simply looking for ransom.
Okay. So it's not necessarily a matter of that. I mean, and when you say they don't have to kidnap people, you're saying that there's enough people in terms of if you pay them enough money, there's enough people out there who won't necessarily, they don't have to be kidnapped and forced to do certain things. They'll do it because the money is there.
Exactly. And, you know, organized crime, especially in Mexico, is the saying, plato plomo, where you can be offered the bribe for your services or you can have your life threatened.
Right. We're talking to Tristan Reed, and he is providing us an update on Mexico. We're finding out what's going on with the Mexico situation. Always something that we got to keep abreast of because Mexico is on our border, right on the border of Texas and other places. But we're talking about the border issues, the crossing, the cartels, the drugs, and also some recent startling dynamics. And maybe this is just more in the news now, but the Mexico cartels creating their own networks, their own hacker brigades, their own communication networks, and everything else. We're talking about all these issues right now. We got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. We're going to continue this conversation. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been getting our international security update with some of our experts from Stratfor. Stratfor is a private intelligence firm. You can find them at stratfor.com, but they provide analysis on a number of different issues around the world. We've been talking about two issues today. We've been talking about Africa, and now we're talking about Mexico and what's going on. We've got Tristan Reed. He's a Mexico security analyst at Stratfor. He's on the line with us providing some updates about what's going on with Mexico. And we've been really talking about some kind of new things that's in the news right now about these cartels kidnapping communication experts, engineers, network specialists, hackers, in order to create hacker brigades and create their own kind of radio narco in which they can communicate privately out of the ears of law enforcement and military and intelligence. We're talking about these things today. Tristan, you know, with this whole dynamic, there was an interesting article on Vice and other places where they were talking about these telecommunication specialists and hackers, you know, being, you know, disappearing. One guy used to work for the U.S. Navy disappearing, and he used to invent certain telecommunication processes in order to be able to listen to certain things. Is this a matter of kind of that they're trying to get rid of people who can harm them, but then they're also trying to, you know, maybe get some of the top talent to say, we want you to be able to help us create our own hacker network, maybe as we diversify, we can't rely on drugs, but now we're going to go into cyber.
No, we haven't seen any indicators of cartels making any significant push into cyber-related crimes yet. However, that's, of course, you know, very much a possibility in the future because Mexican cartels will expand into any illegal enterprise that can make a substantial amount of revenue for them. You know, when it comes, but like I was saying before, you know, there's plenty of expertise out there that's willing to work for a fee for organized crime in Mexico. Mm-hmm. You know, so the expertise is out there. They can diversify the communications in any way. You know, whether it's using satellite phones or social media or the more you know, secretive communication processes via the internet. And they can do it, and they will build out as many different modes of communication as possible.
You know, I was reading, they were saying that the Mexico authorities confiscated 76 antennas, 81 repeaters, 655 handheld radios, 400 cell phones, you know, all with this whole private communication network, which is really kind of incredible. Like you said, I mean, the money is there. With the diversification and with some of these cartels getting smaller, you know, with these things, is this still going to be something they're going to be able to do? You know, since the cartels are getting smaller and smaller, do you think we'll see an increase of this? That means there's going to be a whole bunch of own private network areas amongst a whole bunch of different cartels.
Mm. Yes. What we will see is we'll see more separate communication networks. You know, Los Zetas were the ones that really made the headlines with their own radio networks, mm-hmm. but, you know, we've seen similar networks emerge in, you know, Michoacan with the Knights Templar and as well as Sinaloa. And as we see smaller and smaller groups emerge, we will still see, because they have the money to pay for the expertise, to buy the supplies needed to build up these networks. You know, I mean, even the small, what I now call this street gangs that the Gulf cartels become, they're still pushing significant amounts of drugs across the border, which means they're making a substantial amount of money. So they will still have the resources to do this. So we'll see communication networks that are operated by many different groups as opposed to one giant criminal organization like the Los Zetas were.
You know, you mentioned the Knights Templar and interesting dynamics, and this is being talked about more and more. Give us who are the Knights Templar in terms of Mexico? Who are these people, and what are they doing right now in terms of the cartels?
The Knights Templar is one of several powerful criminal organizations that emerged in Michoacan state in Mexico. They first started off as La Familia Michoacana, but then the leadership of La Familia broke apart. They went to war with each other. The bulk of La Familia decided to rebrand themselves as the Knights Templar. They've made substantial amount of money in producing and trafficking meth, but they've also engaged in illegal mining and logging. Extortion, kidnapping, of course, are one of their main parts of revenue as well. But over the last year, Michoacan saw this emergence, or actually over the last couple of years, Michoacan saw this emergence of self-defense militias. Militias that popped up in rural parts of Michoacan that had the goal of pushing out the Knights Templar. This, along with Mexico City's efforts to pursue the leaders of Knights Templar, caused the group to essentially be dismantled. But this is not as substantial in terms of the reality on the ground, because with each one of the leaders of the Knights Templar to fall, they were quickly replaced by other Michoacan gangs.
You know, when I was thinking about the Knights Templar, I mean, it's this medieval military religious order, you know, and that was designed to defend pilgrims and everything else. Was this name picked on purpose in order to kind of, you know, help with the recruitment, help to see them as something a little bit more than just a regular cartel? I mean, what, you know, was this a strategic dynamic for them?
Absolutely. The name was intentionally designed to sort of mimic their propaganda and their ideas, their claimed ideology. You know, all cartels in Mexico have emphasis on propaganda and disinformation. La Familia Michoacana took it a step further and created this ideology about the organization, pseudo-religious, where there was more. They were more than just drug traffickers. They were helping society.
They're like Robin Hood almost.
Exactly, but in reality, they were meth traffickers, and they engage in kidnapping, extortion, and they wreak havoc on societies and in their areas where they operate. So the ideology is something that they carry in the propaganda, but it has real no meaning inside the organization.
You know, as we look at this dynamic of kind of the Knights Templar, and I know, you know, the Mexico Marines and the government has really kind of been, you know, trying to tackle this issue. Are they now becoming one of the prime cartels in Mexico? Are they kind of, you know, taking more ground because of what they've done and of their branding and the misinformation, the propaganda? Are these the next players that we have to contend with?
Knights Templar?
Yes.
Well, not the Knights Templar. The leadership of the Knights Templar has the top leaders. They've been arrested or killed. However, there's been splinters from the Knights Templar. There are other large organizations that come from Michoacan. One in particular is Cartel de Jalisco. In English, would be the New Generation Cartel of Jalisco. That's really the major player to emerge from that region of Mexico. You know, Michoacan organized crime, all the activities that were there were largely controlled by crime bosses that were in Sinaloa State or in Tamaulipas State for quite a while. Over the last few years, though, organized crime from this region has gained their independence, and they've been expanding rapidly in Mexico. There are several other groups that come from Michoacan, operate both in the United States and through Central America.
You know, as we look and you know, I mean, Mexico had been a big tourist area for many Americans and also people from other Western countries. And then a whole bunch of alerts start coming out. Hey, Mexico is a no-go zone. Are we seeing the security situation kind of changing right now to where things are stabilizing, that this can be a tourist area again? Or is this still, you know, if you had to kind of give recommendations for people, is this still kind of a no-go zone?
You know, the one thing about Mexico, and it's just like with the United States, you can't categorize the entire geography by one security assessment.
Right.
You know, just with major cities in the U.S., you have neighborhoods that have higher crime rates than others. It's the same thing applies in Mexico. The border region with Tamaulipas in Texas, the security situation in most of that area is very poor right now. You do have rampant gang violence. However, there's been improvements in other locations. You know, Juarez, it's a place that I've traveled quite a bit over the last few years. And the security improvements in Juarez, for instance, is night and day. I mean, within a few minutes crossing the border, you'll see very noticeable changes just based on improved security. And then there's lots of tourist areas of Mexico, which are still quite safe. Some are safer than U.S. cities. It's important to know where the violence is going on in Mexico, though, and it's important to stay up to date so that you know that you're not traveling to a location where there's been rising insecurity.
We've been talking to Tristan Reed. He's a Mexico security analyst at Stratfor. He's been giving us an update on the situation there, a security update with the cartels, but also just for travel, making sure that you stay safe while you're out there. Thanks so much, Tristan, for coming on the show. We're going to be checking back in with you guys at Stratfor in an upcoming months because we always want to stay abreast of what's happening right on our border. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Fed Access. We'll be back next week with a new show, so we'll talk to you then.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.